whole thing is yours. It's
no.
Good morning. Welcome to the April 10th meeting of the House Committee on Economic Development and Trade. We have a number of bills up this morning, ranging from how we handle museums to a number of great bills on brownfield revitalization. And we will begin. We have some members here to testify for House Bill 3139. So we'll begin by opening a public hearing on House Bill 3139, the Arts Commission and High Desert Museum. And I'll invite forward Senator Betsy Johnson and Representative New Bueller and invite Mr. Crawford to give us an orientation to the bill, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3139 adds museum, exhibit, design, and allied fields to the definition of arts. It requires the Oregon Arts Commission to, when determining grant eligibility, take into consideration regional differences in arts and cultural development. The committee is being asked to consider the Dash 2 amendments. The Dash 2 amendments replace the measure. They add museum-related activities to the definition of arts. It requires the Oregon Business Development Department Director to, when determining grant eligibility under the arts program, take into consideration regional differences in arts and cultural development, as well as promote investment in communities where engagement in arts and cultural development is limited. The Dash 2 amendments have a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Excellent. And I'll note that I neglected to say we also have a bill on greyhound racing on the docket, too, and that will come up at the end of the docket. So welcome. Please speak in any order. Representative Bueller, I assume it might be your turn to kick this off.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll kick things off. For the record, my name is Newt Bueller. I represent House District 54, which is most of the city of Bend, and I appreciate you giving me a substantial portion of your morning. We're starting off in a more beautiful fashion, talking about art. We'll get to the dirtier brownfield bills later, but I will try to be judicious with your time. There's a number of people here from the arts community, and specifically Central Oregon, that are supporters of the High Desert Museum, to explain the details and the origin of this bill. In brief, what we're really doing here is restoring language that allows arts and cultural organizations that previously have been eligible for funding to once again compete for those grants. We're restoring the status quo essentially to what's been the original intention of 1967 legislation. And this is important because there has been, I believe, because of changes in terms of the rules from the Oregon Arts Commission, geographic unfairness introduced into the process of distributing these competitive art grants. You'll hear more about that in the details. And I will hand it off to Dana Whitelaw, who is the very effective executive director of the High Desert Museum.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Leininger and members of the committee. My name is Dana Whitelaw. I'm the executive director of the High Desert Museum, and I'm testifying in support of House Bill 3139-2. The purpose of the bill is to clarify the existing statutory language, ensuring equitable support for high-quality arts and cultural organizations and programming throughout our state. First, the bill clarifies that the statutory definition of arts includes museum-related activities, such as exhibitions, collections care, and educational art activities. That provision makes express that museum activities use art in various forms to interpret our culture and sense of place. Importantly, including museum activities in this definition aligns with the work that is supported by the National Endowment for the Arts. Aligning Oregon's statutory definition with the NEA is clearly good public policy. Second, the new language instructs the agency to promulgate rules for grants which take into account the regional differences throughout Oregon. Those rules should ensure that the eligibility criteria for grant awards is transparent, objective, and equitable in addressing public access to arts and culture where opportunities are more limited. Funding strategies should reflect the variation that we see across the state in access to arts experiences. Most fundamentally, I believe this bill restores the original intent of the 1967 legislation, Senate Bill 145. At that time, legislators articulated that the premise was to encourage the arts to flourish in Oregon, and not to focus on the type of art, but rather the quality. This bill seeks to restore that premise of promoting quality art, whatever form, throughout the state. The High Desert Museum has benefited from operating support and arts learning grants since 2012, until we were deemed ineligible in 2016. For those of us east of the Cascades, the closest dedicated art museum is in Eugene. That's 130 miles away. The High Desert Museum addresses the need of providing equitable arts and culture experiences across a broad swath of the state that does not have adequate access. For example, the High Desert Museum has become a leader in STEAM, that's science, technology, engineering, arts, and math education, and we're proud to say that we're one of four organizations in the nation to receive a prestigious STEAM grant from the Institute of Museum and Library Services. This project is examining the best ways to partner with libraries and provide rural families with STEAM experiences. In my 9 years at the High Desert Museum, I've seen multiple arts organizations fold under the funding challenges in our region. These organizations include the Cascade Festival of Music, the Nature of Words Literary Festival, Arts Central, which is the Arts Learning Center in Bend, and just last week, the only nonprofit visual arts studio and gallery put out a message of their financial crisis. Central Oregon is booming economically, but our arts organizations are not. After determining that the High Desert Museum was not eligible for operating grants or arts learning grants, the Arts Commission did not award any arts learning grants in Central Oregon last year. Why? No one else applied, and the High Desert Museum was ineligible to apply. With House Bill 3139-2, the legislature has the opportunity to clarify its intent and provide guidance to the agency to distribute its limited grant monies equitably throughout Oregon. Arts and culture anchors like the High Desert Museum provide arts experiences that are simply not available otherwise in many parts of Oregon. With over 7,000 Native American art objects, a significant Western art collection, permanent exhibitions of sculptures, the museum offers high-quality experiences and a lens through which to explore our world more deeply. It's our job to train the eyes of our youngest Oregonians to see things in a new light, add inspiration, awe, and aesthetic beauty. I'll close with a quick story. In Central Oregon, our reach is extensive and inclusive. The museum welcomes 170,000 visitors and 12,000 students each year. And just last week, we welcomed all the Head Start families, preschool families, in Central Oregon for a new program that we call Little Wonders. For most of these families, they've never visited the High Desert Museum before. We expected 400, and over 800 came through our doors. Through this program, we provide each Head Start family with a membership so they can enjoy the museum all year, and a gas card for every trip they make to the museum to remove the barrier of transportation costs. With this, we've given these families their first museum experiences. On that evening, when we had our 800 families, I walked through the exhibitions and saw pure joy, inspiration, and awe on the faces of not only the preschoolers, but the rest of the families as well. And only one person was lashed to their cell phone. That's a huge accomplishment. Those many extended families now have access to this cultural treasure in our state. For a few of these families have the means and therefore the habit of visiting places like the Portland Art Museum or driving to Eugene for a museum experience. House Bill 3139-2 will allow us to ensure that arts and culture organizations in rural areas of Oregon provide high-quality arts experiences. Thank you so much for taking the time to hear this morning.
Thank you very much. For the record, Betsy Johnson, I proudly represent Senate District 16, the Northwest Coast. However, in this heart, there still beats a Central Oregon girl. I was born in Redmond, and by way of full disclosure, both of my parents at different times served on the board of the High Desert Museum, as did I. And so I know the institution well. I'm here for two purposes. I think the case that Ms. Whitelaw and Representative Bueller have laid out is accurate. I believe that there has been some geographic inequity in the application of some of the grants. There is an Oregon on the east side of the mountains, and I think sometimes we need to remind our agencies about that. Over the weekend, after speaking with Ms. Whitelaw on the telephone, I spoke with Chris Harder, the director of OBDD, the Oregon Business Development Department, as well as Nick Batts. The agency has an interest in trying to get this bill in a condition that it can pass. They were a little worried that it it might be too broad at one point. But I'm here to ask that you keep the bill moving and pledge to you that we will get the requisite amendments fixed on the Senate side. I am assured that there is goodwill towards this bill and an interest to address the issues raised by Ms. Whitelaw, but in one that keeps the door fairly narrow. And so that's my promise to you all. If you're inclined to keep, I think, this very fine piece of legislation going, support for a wonderful cultural institution in Central Oregon. I know that there have been some near-death experiences at the High Desert Museum. We also, in my private life, are donors, so I've had the opportunity to know a little bit about the veracity of Ms. Whitelaw's statement that while Bend is booming, some of the cultural institutions struggle. And I think this bill goes a long ways towards righting that inequity, and we'll get it shipshape if you'll keep it moving. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for the panel? Representative Post.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quick question, Representative Buehler, maybe first, because you were involved in the amendment as well as the original bill. I'm trying to figure out on page 2, line 3, which is J, motion pictures television is already in. We're adding and radio. So, of course, as you know, that would pique my interest. So as soon as I was reading that, so if I'm understanding right, the desire of this bill is to do several things, but for you and for where you're going and Senator Johnson, is the High Desert Museum. What does line J have to do with it, I guess? I'm just trying to figure out, is that addressing an old problem? Do you know? And perhaps we have help.
Looks like perhaps we can have
here, take
Mr. Howell step in.
Thank you, Senator. Chair Leininger, for the record, my name is John Powell, representing the High Desert Museum. Chair Leininger, Representative Post, to answer your question, on page 2, line 3 of the draft, that is, I believe, just a legislative council change. Radio was already included. It just adds the and.
Yeah. It looks to be so just a grammatical improvement.
Right. No, I saw. Sorry. Follow up.
Please, yes.
I saw that it was there. It just, I'm trying to figure out what it has to do with everything else, because we're defining art with music and drama and creative writing and on and on and on, and then specifically adding the museum-related activities, and then sort of out of nowhere you have what's already in the statute, but it is new language slightly with the J and the and. I guess what I'm getting at is Senator Johnson talked about perhaps some changes over in the Senate. I don't want to stop this. I think this is a great bill. I have a problem with that section J, that perhaps striking that, because I don't see the connection.
I think LC just, while they were in there, cleaned it up, mm-hmm. which they do randomly. They just look, oh, that's wrong, and change it. And then it's in the middle of your bill, and you end up having to explain it to guys like you. I think that's what happened.
Representative Buehler, did you want to add to that?
If I may, Chair.
Call me a liar.
Thank you very much. And Representative Post, I think the last thing we want to do is reclassify out radio as not an art form. I'm sure you'd agree.
I couldn't hear you.
I'm sure you would not want us to classify radio out as being part of the classification of art.
Take it out?
Yes. That's not what you're asking, right?
Well, yeah, I am. Sorry. Yeah, I am.
Because it was previously in statute.
Okay. All right. Well, it's the first time it's been brought to my attention, so I guess I didn't know that.
Okay. All right. Any other questions for the panel? Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for coming this morning. Quick question. I think Ms. Whitelaw or Mr. Power could explain this, but there was testimony about something happened in 2012. What was that thing that happened in 2012? How did we get here? Apparently in 1967, all was dreamy and good, and then something happened, and now we're here in 2017. So I'm just trying to figure out what happened that we're trying to fix.
In 2012, in 2012, the Arts Commission started a new grants program offering operating support grants along with arts learning. So that was the first time that the High Desert Museum was able to receive that grant. They periodically change the sorts of funding proposals that they request from organizations throughout the state. And then in 2016, we received an email from the Arts Commission stating that we were no longer eligible to even apply for that particular funding opportunity.
Quick follow-up?
Please, yes.
Does anybody know, was there any change in management at the Arts Commission or turnover in the board between 2012 and 2016?
Yes. The executive director left in, I'll have to check on my dates, but Mr. Brian Rogers became the executive director of the Oregon Arts Commission in 2014.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you. I will say that as a former program officer at the Meyer Memorial Trust, I know that funding for arts programs around the state is chronically hard to come by, and that that I think this is a good bill by opening to a modest additional extent or confirming the ability of a wide range of arts organizations to seek funding that addresses the fact that there's a chronic scarcity, but it still addresses the fact that it's a merit-based system. So the fact that groups may compete for funding doesn't mean they'll get funding. They have to show that they warrant it. So in my view, it's both a useful and reasonably crafted solution, and it sounds like the solution may get some further refinement, moves forward to the Senate. But I really appreciate your work on this. We have two more panelists. Do we have any more questions for this witness panel? Okay, thank you so much. All right, and now we have Mr. John Frohnmayer and Mr. Craig Campbell, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Frohnmayer. I'm a native Oregonian. I was born and raised in Southern Oregon and not incidentally worked two summers at the concrete pipe plant of Leininger's in Central Point. I have been involved with the arts in Oregon for some 43 years. I was chair of the committee that selected the art for this Capitol building in 1975, the first percent for art that Oregon has enjoyed. And I'm sure that you all appreciate that you are actually working in a museum. The collection of art that you have here in the Capitol is second to none in any Capitol building in any state in the Union. And from my point of view, the Hank Pender portrait of Governor McCall that is just outside the House chamber is second only to the Night Watch of Rembrandt in my lexicon of favorite portraits. I was chair of the Oregon Arts Commission for 4 years, appointed first by Governor Straub and then reappointed by Governor Attia. I was chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts during that kinder and gentler time of the H.W. Bush administration. And I have also been chair of Oregon Humanities. So I say that not to brag for myself, but simply to tell you that I have been invested in arts for all of my career. And what is before you today, to include museums in the definition of art, is something that should be self-evident, in my view. To have excluded museums in the definition, I think, was an oversight, because it is consistent with the National Endowment's view that museums are very clearly a part of the arts and the place in which arts reside and are appreciated and grow and live. The High Desert Museum is a institution of great merit and multiple charges. And I think that the reason that the Arts Commission did not view it as strictly arts is that it does a lot of things, and it does them all well. But it is the best arts organization in terms of displaying and educating about art in Central Oregon. And as the chair has already identified, the issue that arts organizations deal with all the time is, how do you determine what is excellent? How do you fund when there are limited funds and all of them are competing for the same pot of money, so it's a zero-sum game? And the answer to that is that these committees in the Oregon Arts Commission or the National Endowment for the Arts or any other arts organization makes judgments based upon their artistic background and their artistic knowledge. And that's the way it works. So I think it is a false argument to suggest that this would open the floodgates and it would give the Arts Commission too much to do or too many potential applicants. That's simply not the case. What you want is more applicants, not fewer. Finally, the bill is, as you all know, revenue neutral. That's a very big deal these days. And the arts, while they have all sometimes been political, should be nonpartisan, because if there is anything that has really succeeded in terms of legislation from 1965, when the National Endowment for the Humanities and the National Endowment for the Arts were formed, it is those organizations. And the National Endowment for the Arts gives 40% of its budget to the states every year as a block grant. So the Oregon Arts Commission benefits hugely from the National Endowment for the Arts. And it makes sense to have definitions that are consistent with what the National Endowment for the Arts does. Finally, the last point that I would make for you is that there is a real sense of ownership in the arts, and ownership in the history of Oregon. And it is unfair, I think, to compare what goes on in Ontario or Vail or Klamath Falls or any of the smaller communities in Oregon with what goes on in Portland. I mean, the Oregon Symphony clearly has it up all over the volunteer symphonies of various other places in the state. And yet, what's really great about the Oregon Arts Commission is that it will fund those smaller organizations and judge them by different standards than what goes on in the metropolitan areas. And that allows the arts to be present in all of your districts. And that's what we're really seeking here in terms of parity and delivering services that are valuable to all Oregonians. Thank you for your time.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of the Cultural Advocacy Coalition. It's a coalition that has over 1,400 member cultural nonprofit members statewide. We're here in support of the bill. I'm going to keep my comments fairly brief because you've had far more knowledgeable and august members before you this morning. But suffice it to say that we look at this bill as being favorable because it provides an opportunity for the availability of arts and cultural programs through organizations like the High Desert Museum and other museums, where in some areas of the state they are the organization that provides arts and cultural education to the communities around them. And so to the extent that we are enabling more opportunities for the public to have arts and cultural education and opportunities, that's what we'd like to see. So as a result of that, we're here in support of House Bill 3139.
Excellent. Representative Reschy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is kind of a personal question, but just kind of testing a theory of mine. Mr. Frohnmayer, would you agree with the statement that art is an unwritten history often of a particular culture at a particular time?
Yes.
Thank you.
Well, there you go. That's great. I will note, I appreciate your referring to our family's long relationship. I know my grandfather perhaps was friends with your father.
Otto, he was.
Yeah. That's great. I wanted to note, though, that the Oregon Shakespeare Festival has absolutely been an economic driver of the Rogue Valley. And even when other industries struggled, that really helped sustain the economy. So I think this bill is very appropriately in the House Economic Development and Trade Committee. And with no other comments, we'll close the public hearing on this bill. And thank you for being here. Thank everyone for being here. We'll open a work session on House Bill 3139, and I would welcome a motion from my good vice chair.
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated March 27, 2017 for House Bill 3139.
Vice Chair Brock Smith moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated March 27, 2017. Is there any discussion?
Yeah.
Representative Post.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just in further reflecting on this, though the language is
from way back, and we're not changing the language, although we're removing some commas and adding some ands. I really do have I'm yes on this. I'm fine with this. But I really would, I think we have an opportunity to address something that could be bigger than just what this bill is after. And that is motion pictures, television, and radio, though I consider them art forms. Don't get me wrong on that. But when I see, you know, makes grants to local agencies, to associations or individuals for the development and conservation of programs in the arts, such as this, and then the news section being Section 6, Part A, for engagement in arts and in arts is repeated over and over and over. What I'm getting at is, being a commercial radio person my entire career, I think that that's a line that could be removed at some point and really change the culture of arts. I want the High Desert Museum. I want the art gallery, the so on and so forth. But motion pictures, television, and radio can function pretty much on their own, in my opinion, as I have 37 years experience in that opinion. So,
and also, I just want to note, in the spirit of Southern Oregon, that you were the DJ on the most popular radio station that we listened to during my childhood. So,
by the way,
KDOY.
Also, just for the public record, for the public record, though I was on commercial top 40 radio then, I was also on KSOR, which is Jefferson County Radio, public radio, yeah, and did the jazz show every Friday night from 6 to midnight. And, yeah, so I know both public and commercial radio.
That's great.
And I just, I'm afraid what we're addressing here, and I think it was a long time ago, is public radio. And I, it's the weirdest thing. It doesn't belong with all these other things, I don't think.
Well, I appreciate that comment. So, so that's a good comment, perhaps a signal as to something you'll be working on in the interim. But sure appreciate you noting that. Any other comments on the Dash 2 amendments? All right, so without, is there any objection? So seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3139 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Brocksmith moves House Bill 3139 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the motion carries. And Representative Bueller, would you like to carry that? Okay. Wonderful. All right. Thank you. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 3139. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2968. And welcome Representative Bueller forward to provide his insights. Could you kick us off, please, Mr. Crawford, with an orientation?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2968 requires the Environmental Quality Commission to coordinate with the Oregon Business Development Department and the United States Environmental Protection Agency to create a pilot program for the removal, voluntary removal and remediation of hazardous waste starting January 1st, 2018. It specifies participants who successfully complete the pilot program are released from liability for hazardous waste cleanup under specified state and federal laws. Requires the pilot program to prioritize parties conducting removal or remediation actions for the purpose of developing property for affordable housing, requires the Department of Environmental Quality to report on the implementation of the pilot program to the interim committees of the legislature related to environment and natural resources by September 15, 2022, repeals the pilot program and reporting requirement January 2, 2023, declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair. Esteemed members, for the record, once again, my name is Representative Newt Bueller, representing House District 54, which is most of the city of Bend. As you see on your agenda, there's three brownfield-related bills, and I'm going to open my comments just kind of setting the context of where these come from, and then maybe comment individually, and I'll identify those as we go.
Hang on one second. I'm going to actually open a public hearing on all three of those bills so that you can give your comments at once. So that would be House Bill 2968, House Bill 3137, and House Bill 3142. So please go ahead and orient us, and then you can discuss how each of them fits in. And we don't have a lot of witnesses signed up, so we may be able to just question you all at once.
And that'd be great. And one of my main purposes of introducing these bills is to draw your attention and our other legislative colleagues to the problem with regards to brownfield lands in the state of Oregon. And I first want to thank a wonderful intern we had this summer, Samantha Signer, who is a master's student at Oregon State in public policy and also happens to be one of the star athletes on the ladies Beavers basketball team. But she is the one who really did a large amount of this work. And her charge when she came to me this summer was, I said, Samantha, you know, we have an incredible problem in Oregon with regards to affordable housing. I want you to investigate this problem and think outside the box. And what she identified is that there's a tremendous number of brownfield properties in Oregon. Based on the Department of Environmental Quality review, there's over 13,000 different brownfield sites, and I'm sure Representative Helm is aware of this. And very few of these pieces of property, and some of them potentially are quite valuable pieces of property, they are not being used in any significant way. And there's lots of reasons for that, as you can imagine. You know, there's a certain amount of risk and uncertainty and liability in developing those properties, cost and financing those projects is particularly difficult. But I think one insight which maybe even outweighs those is that the carrying cost of many of these properties is essentially zero. You may ask, why would the carrying cost be zero? Because there's no one's paying property tax on these properties. And that's because the property tax is actually a net of the value of the property in Oregon versus the mitigation cost. So actually the carrying cost of a lot of these brownfield properties is nothing. And actually when you start developing them, putting money into it, then you start raising the value and people have to start increasing their property tax liability. Now, Oregon legitimately has made some good progress in the last couple of years. You may remember that in 2015, a couple of bills came through creating state land banks for the purpose of developing brownfield properties and also allowing some property tax breaks, mainly abatements for development of these types of properties. But unfortunately, they haven't had much impact as of yet. And that's some of the genesis of these ideas is to try to stimulate more interest, more incentive in developing these properties. And the nice thing about these properties is the vast majority of them are already within urban growth boundaries. And importantly, they also have infrastructure to them. And you'll learn as we start to try to find more property developed for affordable housing and other purposes, that one of the big limitations now is infrastructure. And I'm not just talking simply transportation, such as roads, but also dry and wet utilities. And the nice thing about these brownfield lands is they already have the utilities brought up to them. So three concepts for your consideration, these are put out in a measure of good faith to try to stimulate discussion and in debate and interest in this topic. The first one is that I'm going to take off of the list here is 3137. And it's actually pretty straightforward bill. It classifies brownfields as blight. You might think that is kind of commonsensical. But what that does is put these properties, makes them eligible for tax incremental financing. Now, keep in mind what I said just before, that these properties aren't generating property tax revenue. So if you classify them in blight and they're redeveloped and start developing property tax into the future, that money can be brought into the present through offering bonds to help with the development of that property. So that's 3137 really in a nutshell. We get a little bit more complex as we move down to the next two. The second bill, 2968, is really borrowing shamelessly from the state of Pennsylvania. Now, one of the most successful states in the nation in terms of refurbishing and mitigating brownfield sites is Pennsylvania. And you may ask, well, why? Because they had a number of sites from their steel industry days that had to be redeveloped. And interestingly, if you go to Pittsburgh these days, a lot of those old steel mill sites have been mitigated brownfield sites in their healthcare facilities now. And so Pennsylvania as a state is seen as having developed some of the most successful models in terms of addressing the risk and uncertainty of developing these programs. And the main way they did this, where one of the big contributing factors is the Pennsylvania's Act II program, which essentially aligns the requirements, the regulatory requirements across all divisions of government, local, state, and federal. So meaning that a developer, someone who wants to mitigate these properties, can align it and know the hoops to jump through, so to speak, all in one, instead of having different requirements at the local, state, and federal level. Now, you may hear later today from Oregon Department of Environmental Quality that capability already exists in Oregon. And maybe it does. I'm not sure. And I'll be glad to amend this bill and to try to create a work group to make sure that we have the proper administrative rules to allow this kind of alignment between local, state, and federal requirements. That's House Bill 2968. And finally, the third concept is House Bill 3142. And this is an attempt to find new methods of financing of these projects. As you can imagine, brownfield cleanup is an expensive proposition. Representative Klim was intimately involved and very knowledgeable of the concept, was developed, I think, in the 2015 legislative session to create local land banks in order to provide the startup capital to do this work. Those administrative rules have been written. They're in place. The problem is, so far, no local jurisdictions have used them. And it's for a good reason. It's because these land banks need to be capitalized. So 3142 is my attempt to find a source of capitalization for these local land banks. The proposal in this is to use some of the resources that the Energy Trust of Oregon, which has substantial cash flow. I'm not certain what kind of investment vehicles that cash is held in, but that could be defined more clearly in the future. There probably are other options to capitalize these local land banks, but I think it's something that we all should consider and have further discussion, because it would be a key component to providing the resources needed to clean up some of these 13,000 sites across the state of Oregon. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll wrap up, and I'll be glad to take any questions.
Excellent. Thank you. I want to flag for folks in the room and folks on the panel that we have Catherine Williams of the Port of Portland signed up to speak to 2968, which is the one that would enable the pilot project about a unified process and potential ability to prevent liability for people who've made a good faith effort to do the cleanup. And we have Janice Thompson of the Oregon Citizens Utility Board here to speak about the idea of using public purpose charges to help capitalize the Brownfield Redevelopment Fund. Otherwise, we don't have people signed up. So if anyone who's in the room has a view that you feel like would not be represented by those speakers, please feel free to sign up. Rep. Brocksmith, do you have a question? I think, you know, Representative Bueller would be a great resource for us as we talk about the bills. No. Anybody?
I have a question.
Yes, please. Rep. Marsh.
Rep. Bueller, thanks for being here. HB 3142, which it uses money from the Energy Trust, are the projects, I don't see any prioritization for projects. That is, in one of your other bills, you note you put special emphasis on housing. That does not appear to be a particular emphasis in this bill. Is that correct?
Yeah, it certainly could be. That could be just simply a drafting error. But certainly the emphasis in the strategic vision of this is to put top priority on providing affordable housing with cleaning up of these sites.
Yeah, I think that would be a good amendment.
No, we don't have that.
Thank you.
Oh, okay. Thank you. So I'm really interested in 2968, the pilot project. I noticed that we don't have the fiscal on it yet, so it involves a DEQ rulemaking, is that right, to either align or adjust an existing process or create a process. So I want to note that I plan to carry the bill over.
Okay.
since we don't have the paperwork today, but one question I do have, you mentioned that Pennsylvania or the Pittsburgh area maybe has used this process. So there have been other jurisdictions that have used it successfully. How does the mechanism work that would potentially remove the risk of liability under CERCLA or RCRA, kind of Superfund liability, when that's federal liability and this would be a state process? Can you describe a little bit more about that?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a little bit out over my skis on this topic, I'll be frank in admitting. But my belief is that through that process that the agencies agree ahead of time to make the alignment, and then through their administrative approval process, if they accept the approval of one organization to the next level.
So that makes a lot of sense. So the federal agencies would be coming to the table too, saying under these circumstances we would provide some relief from risk of liability.
That's right.
That's helpful. Any other questions about this bill? All right. This is a wonderful set of bills. I really appreciate your being here. If you want to stay in the front row in case we need you, I'll call forward Ms. Williams.
Much.
Thanks. And this is as to House Bill 2968, but since we've opened public hearings on all three, if you wanted to speak to any of the others, we would welcome your insights.
Thank you. Chair Leininger, members of the committee, my name is Catherine Williams. I'm the State Affairs Manager for the Port of Portland. Always happy to come up and follow someone who's so enthusiastic about brownfields redevelopment. I submitted some testimony on OLIS. I will not read it. I will just briefly say that the port supports development of a pilot program to create a voluntary cleanup process that satisfies all applicable state and federal requirements and allows for the issuance of release of liability under state and federal law on completion of cleanup. Currently, cleanups, and we have quite a bit of experience of brownfield cleanup in the Portland area around redevelopment for industrial purposes, but currently these cleanups have to comply with potentially conflicting state and federal cleanup programs. Investigation and cleanup has to be done in accordance with multiple programs, the processes and requirements of which operate differently and independently. There is little opportunity to coordinate across programs and no agency incentives to ensure coordination and consistency. So finding a way to reconcile the programs will lead, in our opinion, to greater certainty for those tasked with cleaning up contamination and establish a path to getting releases of legal liability under all applicable programs under state and federal law. Assuring certainty, speed, and finality of cleanups is very important to cleaning up brownfield contamination sites. For these reasons, we support House Bill 2968.
Excellent. Any comments, questions? I have a question,
yes.
Actually.
Yeah.
So I think that one of the most important things that we can do as a state to support economic opportunity in the state is resolve the uncertainty around liability for the Portland Harbor Superfund site. And I know that a huge number of good-hearted and thoughtful people have been working on this for a really long time. Is this a pilot project that could potentially be applied in that context? And then it looks like the bill that has the potential for creation of urban renewal at ports could potentially be a funding source to help cover the local contribution to the cleanup. Is that the vision, that this would apply to the Portland Harbor site?
Chair Leininger, yes, we think that there is a pathway. We think this could apply both to Harbor and all other types that are not included in a federal Superfund site. And we believe there's a pathway there, because if you're looking at the history we've had to date cleaning up the upland sites, which is an important critical piece in the Portland Harbor Superfund cleanup, you want to clean up the sources of where that contamination is coming in first. My understanding is that EPA has given DEQ a larger role in that. So we believe that's sort of a template for how you can have state and federal more closely coordinate as we get into the phase of the in-water work.
It's really important. I mean, it's an important vision and a bold vision too. So thank you for that creativity and the good thinking. Any comments? All right, thanks, Ms. Williams. And now we would like to invite forward Ms. Wendy Johnson from League of Cities to speak to 3137, which has to do with brownfields defined as blighted areas for the purpose of tax increment financing. I think I can anticipate the framework that you're going to be speaking from. Welcome.
Chair Leninger, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. The League has been involved with the Brownfield Coalition, and I was a part of the Property Tax Exemption Work Group and the Land Bank Work Group, and obviously brownfields are a huge problem to our cities. I know the City of Bend and City of Beaverton are both interested in this bill, and adding the word brownfields to what qualifies as blighted. So we support that part of the bill.
Okay.
The part that I'm concerned about is on the second page. The bill also changes the definition of municipality. Right now, urban renewal can only be done by a city or a county. And this bill seems to add ports to that mix of who can do urban renewal. And that issue hasn't been addressed. We actually work in partnership with ports. The cities do, and so do the counties. Some examples are the City of Hood River entered into a partnership with the Port of Hood River to do the whole riverfront that some of you may have been to that has extended jobs quite significantly. But there was a loan agreements and such to make all that happen. The City of Newport is another example that worked in partnership with the port. And then on the county side, Columbia and Coos County. The ports presently do not have this urban renewal authority, but instead the land is can be a part of an urban renewal area if you work in partnership with the county or the city. This seems to allow the port itself to create authority as I read it, and I just wanted to flag that issue. And then you get into all those limitation issues, as you've discussed in this committee, about urban renewal, of what are the debt limits for the port if it's that area. So if you look at lines 36 and 37, it says that municipality means any county, city, or port organized under Chapter 777 or 778 with respect to an urban renewal area within the municipality that contains a brownfield. So it seems to sound like as long as you mark the area and you have a brownfield in the area, the whole port could be, you know, any bounds. And so I'm just not sure what the intent was, if it was supposed to be limited to brownfields or any part of the port, because it seems to swoop in this authority. So I flag it as a question. I literally looked at it Friday and was wondering what that part of the bill was. And so I just raised the question, and I haven't worked with our cities to figure out what their position is on that issue, because I think we all thought it was a brownfield bill. And the port's obviously been very involved with the brownfield issues. And there are many brownfields in port areas. So that's the question we raise. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Uh-huh. Any questions for Ms. Johnson? I see maybe do we have...
I just wondered if Representative Bueller wanted to address that at all.
All right. Thank you so much. And Representative Bueller, we'd like to call you up. And if you'd like to speak to that issue, that'd be great.
Yeah, I can't speak specifically to why that was drafted in that fashion. This is more focused on cities and counties. We'd be more than willing to work with advocates to clarify that language and make it acceptable to all.
Ms. Williams, would you be interested in coming forward and adding, or do you not have additional thoughts on that?
I would need to look.
You need to come up. And Mr. Landauer, we'd love to have you come forward, too, if you've got.
Chair Leininger, members of the committee, we certainly wouldn't want to add language that would prevent us from doing what we're doing today with respect to the Port of Portland. I don't want to speak for the Oregon Public Ports Association, but I think we could work on something with the League and others to try to satisfy concerns. But we don't want to not be able to tackle these big brownfield sites and small brownfield sites. So I would want to make sure we had an opportunity to look at the language.
Mr. Landauer, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yes. Chair Leininger, members of the committee, Mark Landauer here on behalf of the Public Ports Association. I'd agree with Ms. Williams that we don't want to change the current practice whereby cities or counties can partner with ports. I would just mention, though, that it's interesting to see what happens when the cities see that glass slipper going on another foot. That's all that I'll have to say at this point. Thank you.
Well, you have particular insight, yes, given the various roles that you have. That's interesting. Any comments, questions for this group of witnesses? I will note that I know that the Portland Harbor cleanup has been really hard to get across the finish line for a lot of reasons that deal with federal processes. And I certainly welcome, if you have a negotiated amendment that would help address concerns about ports, I'd be open to that. But personally, I'm quite interested in having there be sufficient authority that a body that is in a position to deal with something like the Portland Harbor would have the ability to undertake a project like that, if all other concerns and interests of stakeholders were reasonably addressed. Because so far, I mean, I think is it accurate that the Portland Harbor Superfund site encompasses more than or extends beyond simply the boundaries of one city? And
Chair Leininger, in the Portland Harbor Superfund, it's the Willamette River in the city of Portland, and not all sites are Port of Portland sites, as you know.
So if the city of Portland were to choose to create an urban renewal site and otherwise all other stakeholder interests had been addressed, theoretically that is a funding source that could help support the local contribution to dealing with that issue?
Chair Leininger, I will check, but my belief is yes.
Okay.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay.
I believe that's correct.
Representative Bueller,
yeah.
As our resident authority on Portland.
No.
Again, out over my skis.
You're doing a great job. Thank you.
I'm happy to be the convener and get the ports and the cities together and to work out acceptable language if we can.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you. So, so we will continue with other bills here. I want to note that a couple of bills that we have on the docket today are not going to be worked today, either for need for amendment reasons or fiscal paperwork reasons or other reasons. And because of where we are in the calendar, we need to carry those forward so that they don't die just by virtue of not having been worked. But for all of the folks whose bills that we're not working today, please note that we are aware of that, and we're going to make sure that we use the magic language that enables us to carry them forward. So thank you both, all three of you. You can go have a seat. And now we will invite forward the witnesses for House Bill 3142, Janice Thompson of the Oregon Citizens Utility Board and Jeff Bissonette, also of the Oregon Citizens Utility Board, who are signed up to speak to the notion of using the public purpose charge, 10% of that, to help capitalize a brownfield redevelopment fund. But you can speak to anything you want.
Chair Leininger, members of the committee, I'm Janice Thompson, Advocacy Director for CUB. And CUB was created by a ballot measure in 1984 to serve as a residential customer advocate in utility matters. And we work both in the regulatory arena before the Public Utility Commission as well as here in the legislature. So CUB understands and by no means opposes the underlying goal of this bill to facilitate brownfield remediation. However, we do oppose the proposed funding mechanism. CUB supported a major energy utility reform bill back in 1999 that included establishment of the public purpose charge for energy efficiency investments in renewable energy, cost-effective renewable energy programs. These dollars come from a 3% public purpose charge on total revenues of Portland General Electric and Pacific Power. It represents a small surcharge on all customer bills. And instead of each of those utilities, you know, setting up their own programs, the bill laid the groundwork to create for a nonprofit entity, which is the ETO. They are subject to rigorous oversight by the PUC and have been operating quite effectively since they got started after this bill was passed a while back in 99. So a key point then is that these are ratepayer dollars from two utilities, and though these are major utilities, they do not serve all Oregonians. Therefore, an initial point of opposition is that it's inappropriate to redirect these dollars from these utility service areas to a statewide program. Indeed, such a diversion seems most likely to run afoul of the Uniform Taxation Clause of the state constitution. And they're just kind of a basic principle of fairness that doesn't seem to be met by saying money from ratepayers in one part of the state for programs outside of those utility areas. But even if the loans were just in the PGE and Pacific Power territory, we would still have concern, and that reflects just the importance of these dollars benefiting ratepayers overall of these two utilities. The ratepayer dollars are diverted from use by the ETO for these cost-effective renewable energy efficiency programs, then costs to all the customers of these utilities increase. These investments save ratepayers money over and above the surcharge because they mean that utilities do not have to purchase more expensive electricity. And the benefits aren't just going to the customers that undertake these projects. There are system-wide benefits. For example, for every $1 that ETO invests in energy investments, all utility customers save $3. The bill, does specify that the ETO is to consider energy-related factors when evaluating brownfield remediation loans, but that just doesn't translate into using these public purpose dollars for projects with this kind of $1 investment providing $3 worth of benefit ratio. The loan approach certainly would mean that ETO would, eventually be paid back. They're not really set up to essentially serve as a bank, and presumably they would have increased administrative costs due to that, adding that function. And even if the requested 10%, set aside or of this the public purpose dollars isn't all being used at one time, these dollars would essentially be earmarked and could not be used for the projects that the ETO was set up with on behalf of Portland General Electric and Pacific Power customers. A final note is that all the modeling done by these two utilities in regard to meeting like their greenhouse gas reduction goals, kind of reflect that the ETO would continue to function as it is. And so I think another issue is that with this 10% diversion, you would start to see problems in meeting those goals. So, while fully recognizing the enormous value of brownfield remediation and the challenges in funding this kind of work, CUB does oppose 3142.
Excellent. Thank you for that input, Mr. Bissonnette.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. In the introduction, I'll offer a correction at the same time. Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association, used to be with CUB for a long time, but now representing the solar industry.
Okay.
And so just very quickly, wanted to offer comments, one, to underscore the ratepayer focus of these funds that Ms. Thompson just talked about. Also to note that, the solar installers around the state do benefit from a chunk of the public purpose funds. Those are pretty critical, source of funds for solar installers that are putting solar panels on roofs of homes and businesses and some large-scale solar projects. And so anything that sort of, and the renewables portion of the energy trust is relatively small, and so anything that kind of comes near that raises our eyebrows and concerns. And then lastly, I just want to underscore kind of the inherent economic development nature of the of energy trust and energy trust funds. Speaking from the perspective of the solar industry, those installations do create jobs, do create ongoing economic benefits for the communities. And so I guess I'd want to say that as we look at the vast needs of economic development in the state, let's not play one off the other. If one is working, let's keep it there, and let's look at other ways to support other needed economic development. Thank you for the opportunity to offer comments. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Really appreciate that. And do we have any comments for this panel of witnesses? questions. I have a thought on this. I really appreciate your testimony. I think I know that there is some difference of opinion about the public purpose charge and whether everyone supports the current use of it and the current quantum of it and things like that. I think given the complexity of that conversation that I am not actually expecting to work this bill or hold it over today, but I do want to note that I think Representative Buehler made a really good point in trying to initiate the conversation about how we capitalize a brownfield revitalization fund, and it could be, in my view, that an answer is some variation on what Representative Buehler suggested, but it would require conversation with a group of stakeholders over a period of time to get to something that a broad range of people felt were palatable. And it could be that the public purpose charge is not the right answer. I just don't have enough information to definitively know that. But I do think it warrants – how to capitalize that fund warrants a conversation with a whole bunch of stakeholders across a range of ideas that not everyone in this room probably agrees about the merit of at this moment. So thank you for your testimony. Thank you, Representative Buehler, for bringing that bill forward. I think it's really important and hopefully something we can make progress on into the future. So you can have a seat. We are going to work one of the two remaining bills in this set of three bills. We've lost Representative Buehler. That's all right. Oh, no, there he is. Great. We're going to work one of the two remaining bills and hold one of them over. And I want to provide some background for folks in the room because it may – I don't want anyone to get confused about the intention. Our committee is a committee that has a deadline of the 17th to work bills out of our committee. The revenue committee does not have that same committee deadline. The amendment that is – it sounds like folks are agreeing to in principle to – House Bill 3137 to deal with the port issue as a potential creator of urban renewal districts and to make sure it's eliminated or narrowed in a way that can make the stakeholders comfortable. That is something that would require an amendment and a fiscal and perhaps could not be done in time for our committee to work it. So what I'm going to seek a motion from my good vice chair on is to move House Bill 3137 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and subsequent referral to House Revenue for further work. So it's not negating the good conversation that we had before, but just to actually facilitate that. And then 2968 to create the pilot project, I think that that's a good bill that warrants working, but we don't have all of the paperwork to get it done today, so that's one that we'll carry forward for a future work session. All right, so with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bills 2968, 3137, and 3142, and open a work session on House Bill 3137, which clarifies that blight is encompasses brownfields and will receive further work and revenue. Rep. Brocksmith.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3137 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the House Revenue Committee be added.
Vice Chair Brocksmith moves House Bill 3137 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that a subsequent referral to House Revenue be added. Is there any discussion? Yeah, we any discussion other than the fact that the amended language was not needed in that motion?
If you could just restate the motion.
Yeah, how about if we do that one more time without the no, and you know we have a script here. And just,
Madam Chair, I'll, do I need to?
Let's just start fresh.
Remove my old motion.
You can withdraw it.
Sure.
Madam Chair, I'll withdraw my previous motion.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3137 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the House Committee on Revenue.
Good.
Be added.
Vice Chair Brocksmith moves House Bill 3137 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the House Revenue Committee. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion carries, and that will move forward to House Revenue. Now, let's see, we do not need to open a work session on 2068, and so we will thank Representative Bueller for his good work. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3252, which pertains to greyhound racing. Invite forward Mr. Stephen Kafouri and invite Adam Crawford to orient us to the matter before Mr. Kafouri begins. Then we'll have two panels, and I'll articulate those folks in just a second.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3252 prohibits greyhound racing. It removes statutory language pertaining to greyhound racing, allows a person to operate a public training track or kennel for breeding and training of greyhounds to race outside of Oregon if licensed by the Oregon Racing Commission.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Kafouri.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Stephen Kafouri. I'm here representing Great 2K USA, which is a national nonprofit that is working to pass laws to protect greyhounds and promote the adoption of ex-racing dogs. And Representative Post has taken advantage of that, had a greyhound that was a rescue dog. This may be the easiest vote that you ever take in your career here. 3252 simply removes from the statutes obsolete language regulating greyhound racing. There has been no greyhound racing in the state for 12 years, and the track has been torn up and the facility is being used for something else. There's no indication that anybody has any desire to bring greyhound racing back. What this bill is not about, my client has a very simple, narrow focus on greyhound racing. They do not care about, and this bill has no effect on, motorcycle racing, horse racing, car racing, or University of Oregon track team. I understand there's some people going to be talking here after I leave, suggesting that there might be some problems in the state. My client spoke directly with two of the three owners of U.S. Off Track, which is the largest one of the largest ones of the hubs that does electronic voting. Electronic gambling that's located here, partially in the state. These people, two of the three, had no knowledge of the bill when they were found out about it. They said they have no interest. It would not affect their business in the slightest. They have no desire to leave Oregon. And statement that they might do that is not coming from the people who own the business. It should have no effect on the business, should have no effect on anybody else's business.
I'll note that there are some folks who plan to testify later, and when you're called up, you're welcome to give your perspective. Do we have any questions? Did you finish your presentation?
I finished my presentation. It's a very simple bill. Okay. I don't need to talk long.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Kafouri? All right. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. And now we will call forward Jerry Zimmerman, Randy Bowden, and Patty Lehnert. On deck, we have Dave Nelson and Kirk Schaefer, or Schaefer.
Okay, I guess I'll go first. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to provide testimony this morning against House Bill 3252. My name is Jerry Zimmerman. I am a vice president with U.S. Off Track. My responsibilities are centered around financial analysis and economic planning. U.S. Off Track was founded in 1999 and opened in early 2000 in Portland and has operated ever since then. And we operate an advanced deposit wagering hub, as well as providing some services to other ADW companies. I provided an exhibit, which I think is available, that I'd like to just highlight some of the key points in the exhibit, and then I'll conclude with why, U.S. Off Track. And I just, for the record, since we heard somebody not related to us say that we weren't against it, we are against it, and we do believe it will affect us. So in terms of the economic impact, what I did on the exhibit is I just tried to identify key big things. There's lots of little things, but in three key areas, jobs, revenues, and investment, when we look at those, we think that there's been both a lot of good economic activity, and we think that this would be at risk. We've employed 286 individuals since opening in April 2000. We've averaged a staff headcount of over 61 employees over the last 5 years, and that's 2012 through 2016. We've paid over $21.9 million, and I think that was the last payroll when I did this up a couple of weeks ago, so it's probably over $22 million now, in wages and over $6.5 million in employment benefits and taxes since opening. In terms of revenues, we've paid the Oregon Racing Commission license fees of over $1.6 million, and we've paid source marketing fees in excess of $600,000 to local racing industry to support the tracks that have been operating here. We've paid over $390,000 in state and county income tax and over $70,000 in tangible property taxes since opening. And in terms of investment, since 2000, we've invested over $2 million in property and equipment for a Portland operation. We've paid various Oregon real estate and property rents in excess of $2.1 million. Now, I'm not, as you know, local business. We have local vendors. We buy concessions. Those are all just regular operating expenses that weren't capitalized, so I don't speak to any of that. I've just included here numbers that we could document off of our general ledgers. We are audited independently. Every year, we also have various state regulatory authorities reviewing and auditing our numbers, too. So these are factual numbers that I put before you. And the point to this is that if Greyhound racing is banned in the United States, we're out of business. I mean, I don't know how that's not impactful, but that's the case. We are out of business. Our racing hub closes down, and those jobs and the economic activity we create is lost. And we strongly believe that this doesn't do anything for, as you heard, this is about a national interest, not something coming out of Oregon to go ahead and promote. This is a national interest looking for a national agenda about banning Greyhound racing, and it's not about what's going on here in Oregon and the economic activity that's happening here in Oregon. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Welcome. You can speak in any order.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Randy Bodine. I am Chief Operating Officer of Amwest Entertainment. We are also one of the hubs licensed through the state of Oregon. And to take it a little different direction, because obviously the numbers would all be the same categories that you just heard, but Oregon and I believe there's 11 licensed hubs, is the largest place in the United States to do what we do. Not only is it the largest, it is considered the gold standard. That has happened because, one, they have an excellent regulatory body in the Oregon Racing Commission, and a regulator in Jack McGrail and Connie Wynn, who make sure that everything is operating, you know, the way they should. Excellent regulatory is a friend of all business like ours. It assures a level playing field. It also assures that the racetracks that we need to do business with have confidence that things are being done correctly in the state of Oregon. The second part of why everyone's in Oregon is because the commission operates a business-friendly environment that is always looking for new ways to help the individual hubs make ourselves better within the confines of the regulations. And as such, that's why that Oregon leads in this area. Having said that, pardon the expression, the wolves are at the door. There's a lot of other states who have these regulations on the books who would dearly love to have this business come out of Oregon into their states. So for me, I think the issue here would be that while on its surface it certainly appears that this bill does nothing except a bit of cleanup, it actually does, in my opinion, send the wrong message. What it would say is that a big part of the business that comes through Oregon is no longer welcome. Whether it directly affects wagering on day one is not really the core issue, although I believe that the people behind this would come back after the wagering sooner or later. Having said that, if to send the message that portion of the wagering business is not welcome has a direct effect, even though I totally agree that Greyhound racing is gone and it's never coming back, the mere amount of money it would take to invest to do this again from the ground up with price of property and building a track is not going to happen. So But what I believe would have a direct effect is the hub funds that we all generate, a good portion of that goes to support the county fair horse racing across the state of Oregon. And so if anything were to happen to any of the hubs where they had to leave for whatever reason, that would directly economically affect all those county fair race meets that are out there. And that trickles down to the convenience stores that won't sell the same amount of fuel, the hotels that won't be as full, the restaurants that won't have as many patrons, because racing is an integral part of those county fairs each year. And so for me, I guess I would just ask that you consider that while on its surface it appears to be of little consequence, that perhaps it can have some ramifications and send a message that could really affect some things that all of us, you know, really want to continue. And in addition to being, when I take off my hat as chief operating officer, I also sit on a committee called the Future of Racing in Oregon. And we deal every month with exactly these issues in terms of what can we do to make sure that racing in Oregon, as it pertains to these fairs, can go on for years to come. And the economic impact that goes with it is very important to everyone. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for this opportunity to speak. My name is Patty Lehnert, and I'm former animal welfare coordinator at Multnomah Greyhound Park. And I've realized that the heart of this bill, it isn't so much about greyhound racing, but what really concerns me is Gray 2K and their clandestine agendas. I just wanted to let you know that when I was serving as animal welfare coordinator at Multnomah Greyhound Park until its closure in 2005, we had a greyhound adoption program that was not only unique to Oregon but unique on the planet. Every greyhound that ended their racing career at Multnomah Greyhound Park was required to enter our nationally recognized adoption program that boasted a 100% placement rate. And in addition to the racers, the retired broods and studs also entered the adoption kennel, and they were cared for daily by professional handlers, one of which is present that will speak shortly. And it was just top-notch. We loved our dogs. We loved our greyhounds here in Oregon. And on race days, they were seen twice by a veterinarian, once on a bench before the races, once immediately following races. And at the end of our racing season, which ran from April until the last week in September, we also tracked every greyhound that ran at Multnomah Greyhound Park, whether they made it to the next track or whether they made it to the next breeding farm, whether it was in Oregon or not. Greyhounds are dictated by instinct, and they're sight hounds whose passion is running. That's what they've been bred to do, and they're cared by professionals that keep them in peak condition. I also think that it's not fair or shouldn't be considered to permanently shut the door on a sport that contributed so much to animal welfare and the state's economy for so long. And I think it's uncalled for to introduce a bill such as 3252 who has backing of those that may have some clandestine agendas. Also, I have a letter submitted by Dr. Linda Blythe, who's with the Oregon State Veterinary College. She's Professor Emeritus. And she asked if I'd read this today. It says, "Hi, my name's Dr. Blythe. I have been the Associate Dean of Students at the Oregon College of Veterinary Medicine and President of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. But this
is a researcher and educator that I send this message to. I have worked with the Greyhound industry in this state for over 25 years. Initially, our faculty was asked by the Oregon Racing Commission to do drug trials and to assume them and make sure that the public was not, and to make sure that the public was aware of these testing methodologies that they could use to detect drugs in racing greyhounds. From this work, we developed legitimate medication withdrawal times for trainers and veterinarians so that greyhounds could continue to run drug-free. The industry worked with me to write two textbooks on the care of racing greyhounds and retired greyhounds that's been supported by the Oregon Racing Commission and the American Greyhound Council. Between these two books, they have sold approximately 15,000 copies in England, Australia, and other parts of the world where greyhound racing exists. I also started and maintained the International Greyhound Research Database, which contains over 1,500 abstracts of all scientific articles written on greyhounds. We first printed in a book that was widely distributed free of cost and now has been put in electronic form through the web of the American Greyhound Council. I update it once a year. My intent with all this work in collaboration with Oregon and the National Greyhound Industries has been to promote and enhance the care of these elite athletes. 10 years ago, I started an elective 40-hour course for senior veterinary students from Oregon State University, Washington State University, and Veterinary College to educate them on the needs of athletic dogs, from greyhounds to sled dogs to sporting dogs, including agility dogs. So in summary, educational and research to benefit greyhound worldwide has been my goal, and I could not have done it without the inspiration and cooperation of the National Greyhound Association. They have been national leaders not only in promoting education and greyhound well-being, but also in greyhound adoption programs, which has placed over 90% of racing greyhounds into good homes. Dr. Blythe goes on to say, I spoke to the legislature a number of years ago when a bill was introduced to ban greyhound racing. It is my strong opinion that it would be wrong to make greyhound racing illegal in this state when the industry has done so much good. Passing this bill into law would be the equivalent, in fact, to passing a law outlawing horse racing, sled dog racing, agility trials, or even pet ownership. To make it illegal for greyhounds to race in Oregon would be grossly unfair and a poor use of legislation. This industry should have the chance to bring greyhound racing back to Oregon and not be singularly prohibited from doing so. I would strongly oppose this bill and what it is trying to do, and would ask you not to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Representative Gomberg, you have a question.
Thank you. Just two questions, Madam Chair. And first of all, let me say for the benefit of our colleagues here, this is an interesting measure. It was sponsored initially by another representative who, for reasons that aren't entirely clear, chose to take his name off the bill last week. And so I was asked to put my name on it to keep the conversation alive. That puts me in the interesting position of being the sole sponsor of a bill that I didn't write. And that brings us to where we are here today. So if I could, for this panel, first of all, for the two gentlemen here, I just want to make sure I understand the point you're making, and that, as I understand it, is that we don't have greyhound racing here in Oregon. We don't anticipate that we'll have greyhound racing here in the future, but you have businesses that are based here in Oregon or have offices here in Oregon that in part deal with all kinds of racing here in Oregon and in other states, and in other states that may involve greyhounds. So if we pass this measure, you would regard that as being unwelcoming to greyhounds, I think that was your phrase, and therefore you would take your businesses someplace else. Is that essentially what you're saying?
If may, I may answer first.
Yeah,
I'll let you go. Thank you, Representative, for the question. Yes, in the short answer is this would be negatively impactful to our business going on right now here in Oregon. It is, you're accurate in how you summarized in that there has not been any greyhound racing for quite some time, and it is unlikely that it would ever come back to the state. However, we do take greyhound wagers from all over the country. In fact, I think the last time I checked, we were taking it from 17 different states. We take them here. We manage that activity and that work here. What this, and again, I'll lend it to my peer here to go ahead and he can speak on this too. But what I see as an analyst, as somebody financially looking at the numbers, what I see is that the earlier testimony given by representative from Gray 2K is that this is a national agenda. This is a national plan. And they've stated overtly that it is their intent to ban greyhound racing. Our business, the majority of our business, is greyhound racing. So it's as an analyst, it's pretty easy. I didn't have to get a master's to do this. It's going to go away. That work goes away. Those jobs go away, and our business goes away, period. I don't, and again, I'm not making, you know, and I don't want this to be perceived as anything, a threat of any sort. It's just that this is indeed the case of what's going to happen factually, you know. Hand it over.
Yes, sir, and again, to start where we left off, I didn't, hopefully it didn't come out that way. I didn't mean to sound like a threat that we were going to leave. What I was really trying to highlight was that by making greyhound racing appear to be unwelcome, I think it sends the wrong message to people that are providing tax dollars that are helping racing in many other ways. And I feel, I mean, there's sort of an overt threat that at some point these people will come back and come after the wagering side of it, which has kind of been, you know, what their history's been. So it's kind of it makes us nervous that the door gets left open a crack when if this bill were to proceed. It's certainly, you know, we would be concerned that in the future it could jeopardize that portion of the business. And if that ever happened, then absolutely, yes, we would have to leave.
And if I may add, just because there's some really good points there were brought up. Also, what happens is, and I think there's another exhibit that's out there that says that greyhound racing is banned in 40 states. That's not accurate. It's not been banned in 40 states. It's just like any form of gambling. It's not legal in that many states. We, you know, if it's banned and then that causes attorney generals in other states to take a look at, okay, do they now change their stance on the state of Oregon taking these wagers? And it opens up the door to other negative, potentially negative effects to the business that's ongoing right now.
Madam Chair, just my second question. I know we have another panel coming. I had a question for Ms. Landers. Thank you for being here today. Twice in your testimony, you made reference to a clandestine agenda. What have I gotten myself into here? What is this clandestine agenda that I'm suddenly part of?
Gray 2K is an animal rights organization, and some of their tactics that have been documented are tied to perhaps other organizations, and also I question Gray 2K on a number of points. I think that if you follow the money trail with the Gray 2K, it's not about animal welfare. I think it's about money potentially. Also, I'm unaware of any greyhounds that Gray 2K have adopted or sponsored for adoption purposes.
Okay, please.
Real quickly, Madam Chair, so if I understand what you're saying, I'm not hearing you objecting to this specific legislation and the language in it. You're objecting to the people who requested the bill.
I am also objecting to anything that has to do with House Bill 3252, because I don't believe greyhound racing should be banned in Oregon, and especially if it's going to impact these hubs economically, why do we want to lose that money in Oregon and have them go to another state?
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Reschke?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mine just a comment. It sounds like we're being asked to ban an activity that doesn't take place in the state. Which doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Thank you. Any other comments for this panel? All right, we have one more panel, and we're running out of time, so I'll thank you for being here and invite forward Dave Nelson and Kirk Schaefer, or Schaffer. And then we'll have a couple of closing moments while we carry over a couple bills to the future meeting.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Nelson. I am a member of the Board of Directors of the Oregon Quarter Horse Racing Association. Most of you wouldn't know me from a fence post. I'm a friend of Representative Clams from years ago. I had a lobbying and public affairs business from the 1970s through 2005, and one of my clients at that time was Portland Meadows. And so during that period of time, a number of things happened in the state of Oregon. 1984, the state, the voters adopted a lottery. 1991, the legislature passed a video poker that had an immediate and deleterious effect on racing in Oregon. During that period of time, then racing disappeared at the Oregon State Fair. Racing disappeared at Klamath Falls. Racing disappeared at Lakeview, and racing disappeared in 2004 at Multnomah Greyhound Park. During that time, there Portland Meadows went through several different ownerships. One of them, the latest ownership, was Magna Entertainment, which became the Stronach Group. They bought in 2000, they bought both Portland Meadows and Multnomah Greyhound Park. And so one of our responsibilities, that time I carried over as one of their lobbyists during their ownership period until I retired in 2008. As part of our due diligence, we went out to probably half a dozen or eight Greyhound farms located in eastern Multnomah County to look at the conditions the greyhounds were raised and trained in. And we found everything to be in order. They were treated very nicely. They were in very good condition. The farms, of course, farms go up and down, and maybe one of the barns had a leaky roof or something like that. But generally, the overall atmosphere on those farms was first class. The during that period of time, the handle for horse racing and greyhound racing, when greyhound racing went out of business, you recall, or just for those of you who are not lingo oriented in horse racing, the handle is the amount of money wagered on the races totally in the state of Oregon. And out of that handle, then a portion is deducted for operation of the racetrack. Portion is deducted for purses for the owners of the racing animals, whether they be horses or whether they be greyhounds, and a number of those things. So 80% plus is paid back to the person, to the patrons who wager on the races. So during that period of time, the total handle during the buildup of the lottery during the 1990s, the number of video poker machines and video gaming screens increased from zero to over 12,000. The total handle on racing went from $120 million down to $63 million. So therefore, it just simply would not sustain the operation of the Greyhound track and the other facilities. We also, a group of us, including under the lobbyists for the Greyhound track in the 1990s, and the horse owners, presented a number of pieces of legislation to mitigate the loss of revenue and to try to preserve horse racing in the state. We succeeded in convincing the legislature to pass a bill allowing us to have 75 video poker machines per facility. We negotiated that hard with then-Governor Kitzhaber. He vetoed it after having negotiated it with us. We passed other legislation to try to mitigate it. Created the platform during the late 90s to invite these advanced deposit wagering hubs. And if I get babbling, just say shut up.
Oh, you're not. You're not babbling at all. The committee is officially over at quarter tilt, and a lot of folks have to start leaving then because they have other meetings
that
they've scheduled.
And I've got to get my wife to an oral surgeon to get a tooth pulled. So you're better off than But anyway, did a number of things during the late 1990s to create the legislative platform or the statutory platform to be inviting to what we call advanced deposit wagering hubs. And these are the people, as Mr. Zimmerman described, who wheel the wagers from Florida to New York to wherever it may be. It's just a processing center like Dakota's process bank cards. So out of that flow of money, the Oregon Racing Commission scoops a little of the money out of it. I think there are statutory limitations, and Mr. McGrail is in the back. He can say yes or no. It was 0.25%. Other states have said, why are we allowing Oregon to scoop out 0.25% of wagers that are on California races? We'll keep that here in California. And as Mr. Zimmerman said, they're structuring their statutes to be inviting for those hubs that come from, that process wagers from those big states, to keep them in state. And so everything that we do that appears to be counter or against or non-welcoming to a breed of race horses, whether it's Arabian horses or whether it's greyhounds or whether it's Appaloosas or whatever it may be, it further puts an incentive for those states to say, keep our racing dollar here in our state to benefit our people rather than giving it to Oregon. And as Mr. Boland said, that there's about $3 million that is scooped out that you don't have to pay for the budget of the Racing Commission. Their licensing fees and the hub monies and the wagering monies come directly to the Racing Commission. They pass on about $500,000 a year to the state of Oregon, or it used to be that. And so everything you do to say, we don't think we like you, gives them impetus to try to move that to their state. So with that, I'll close. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Welcome.
Okay. Hi, my name is Kirk Schaefer, and I'm the official fish out of water here. Real quick, born and raised in Oregon, raised greyhounds since 1980. I was president of the Oregon Greyhound Breeders Association for 10 years, the last 10 right up to when the track closed. When they closed, not only was this track the flagship of tracks throughout the nation, but also the flagship for the adoption kennel. And right now, today, we still have two active adoption kennels running in Oregon. We actually bring greyhounds back to the state to adopt out, whether they're Oregon bred or not. And I still have a few dogs running in Florida, and within the next few months I'm going to be bringing them home. And I just am opposed to this bill, as I would like to still have the opportunity, if I so choose, to raise and race greyhounds in Oregon. Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be really quick. I just, first of all, one of the gentlemen here is being quite humble. I don't know if everybody remembers, but he is the Honorable Senator Nelson.
Oh, no, was the other guy. We were both on.
Oh, the okay. I swear, I thought that was you. Okay. You're not being so humble then. No, thank you. I wanted to point out, and Mr. Kafori said it earlier, I've never been a racetrack person. I adopted Andy, a greyhound, a racing greyhound, several years ago. He's gone on to the great greyhound track in the sky. I miss him dearly. So I see both sides of this thing, but I think it's interesting. I pulled up over the weekend a story from 2015 when this version of this bill was brought up, and then Representative Doherty, who was the chair of the committee, said that the measure was a solution looking for a problem, because what's already been pointed out, we don't have it, and so why run it? So I'm mixed, because I loved Andy, and I hated what he went through. And it changed his life the way he was to what he became when he lived with us. He became a domesticated pal, a friend of our family. But he was a different dog when we first got him. And so I hate that part of it. But since there isn't the racing going on, it does seem like a solution looking for a problem. So I just wanted to add that.
Thank you. All right. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on 3252. Thank you very much for being here. I don't think I missed any questions. Did I miss any questions? All right. And now I am going to carry over the work sessions on the following bills to the agenda for Wednesday, April 12th, House Bill 2968 and House Bill 3252. And seeing no other hands waving with additional business for the committee, we stand adjourned.
Part of the clandestine agenda.
All right.